John Bachman, who pierces in people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, June 21st, 2010. Israel approves the demolition of 22 homes in East Jerusalem. Dock workers in Oakland, California refuse to unload Israeli ship. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The mayor of Jerusalem, Nir Barakat, has asked the city's planning council to approve construction plans in the Silwan neighborhood of East Jerusalem, according to Haaretz. These plans call for the demolition of 22 Palestinian homes to make way for a tourist center, shops, and an art gallery, among other things. After originally putting off approval in March due to U.S. pressure, the city's government seems set to go ahead with the plans despite protests from the community's residents. The people of the area had put forth their own plan, which would have avoided the destruction of homes. It would seem the planning committee did not even consider the alternative plan, to the outrage of the residents. The move comes a day after the U.S. envoy to the region, George Mitchell, finished his most recent trip to the region. Palestinians would like to see East Jerusalem, with the advent of a two-state agreement, to be their capital. U.S. criticism of the government's plans is expected. Within the United States, a California dock workers union, in cooperation with local peace groups, has refused to unload an Israeli ship's goods. 500 workers from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10 and their supporters picketed at the port of Oakland, California. An organizer had this to say: "We want to send a clear message that if you commit acts of piracy on the high seas, if you attack and murder civilians in cold blood, if you build an apartheid wall, if you appoint a racist minister like Avigdor Lieberman who calls for the expulsion of all Palestinians, then we will not honor your cargo here in the port of Oakland." The workers have agreed to not unload the ship for at least 24 hours. The protest comes after the Israeli military attack of humanitarian activists aboard a Turkish vessel this past May. On Sunday, Israeli forces used violence to disperse a protest in Beit Jala. Two Palestinian men were wounded by Israeli soldiers who beat them with fists and sticks, even though the men were not a part of the protest that was occurring. The Israelis also harassed and beat six journalists documenting the protest. They were hit on their legs repeatedly with sticks in the process of covering the events. Elsewhere, the Israeli High Court has denied the appeal of four Palestinian legislators seeking to overturn orders seeking to have them removed from East Jerusalem. The original orders still stand and would have the four men deported from the city if they did not leave on July 2nd. The men have stated their intention not to comply with the orders. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Here is a report on the Friday nonviolent protests in the West Bank from Fridays this week in Palestine.
The villagers of Nalin, together with international supporters, marched after the Friday prayer to their confiscated land where Israel is building the wall. Abu Amira, a member of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in the village, said some of the protesters wore the national dress of the United Arab Emirates and waved Emirati flags in a sign of gratitude to this Arab state for its support to the Palestinian people. Protesters also chanted slogans demanding Israel to remove the Israeli settlements from the West Bank, saying that all of these settlements are illegal. Abu Amira added that Israeli troops fired a number of tear gas canisters at the protesters, causing dozens of them to choke and few others to faint. In the meantime, a number of protesters were wounded when Israeli forces fired rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas at a non-violent demonstration in the village of Bel'in near Ramallah's central West Bank. The demonstration started after the midday Friday prayer and was joined by international and Israeli supporters. Protesters attempted to reach their land, which were confiscated by the Israeli military, to build the wall. They carried Palestinian flags, banners, and signs slamming the Israeli settlement activities in the West Bank and the latest decision to build 1,600 settler units in settlements near Jerusalem. In Bethlehem, dozens of residents from the village of Al-Masr protested the confiscation of their land and the construction of the wall on it on Friday afternoon. Israeli forces did not intercept the protesters who managed to reach their land. The marchers carried signs demanding the release of Hassan Brajiya, who was detained during the last week's protest. The Israeli military accused him of trying to burn a soldier. Eyewitnesses said that he was trying to put out a fire that caught his shoes when he accidentally hit an Israeli soldier. Meanwhile, in the nearby village of Wad Rahal, Israeli troops intercepted the protesters and did not allow them to reach their lands. The military commander warned the protesters that they will arrest everyone if they do not leave in 5 minutes, an order that was ignored by all protesters. Boy Scouts groups took part in the demonstration during which marchers demanded the lift of the siege on Gaza. Protest ended peacefully. In the Gaza Strip, hundreds of Palestinians marched to protest the buffer zone Israel is creating in the northern and eastern side of the Strip. The march called for by the Popular Committee Against the Buffer Zone started from the town of Beit Lahia to the area Israel is leveling to create the extended buffer zone. The march ended peacefully following speeches delivered by the organizers who affirmed their commitment to the ongoing nonviolent resistance to the buffer zone and the siege on Gaza.
Black Hawk down! Black Hawk down! Afghanistan today! NATO is reporting the deaths of 4 occupation soldiers in a helicopter crash in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan today. 3 of the 4 were Australian soldiers, according to the Australian military, and the 4th is an American, according to a U.S. spokesman. 7 other Australian soldiers were wounded. Afghanistan today! NATO is reporting the deaths of 2 occupation soldiers in separate IED attacks in undisclosed locations in southern Afghanistan today. Pakistan today. A dozen militants ambushed a Pakistani military patrol in the northwestern tribal lands, killing 3 soldiers and sparking deadly clashes, according to officials. The incident took place in Kasha village on Rorakzai, the district where the military said on the 1st of June that major combat operations as part of an anti-Taliban offensive were over. Sound familiar? Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. Suicide bombers and 2 car bombs killed at least 26 people and wounded 53 when they drove down a crowded street and blew themselves up simultaneously, security officials reported. The bombers targeted the Baghdad branch of the Trade Bank of Iraq, the conduit for much of the government's foreign exchange transactions and its dealing with investors. A traffic police officer is also nearby, and many traffic police were also among the killed and wounded. A branch of the Iraqi commercial bank was also damaged. Accounts are confusing, however, in that Baghdad security spokesman Major General Qasem al-Musawi says the attackers were suicide bombers whose target was the bank, while others report that the cars were parked some distance apart from each other. Jabala, Iraq, Saturday. Unknown fighters killed 3 Sawa, or awakening militiamen, in a drive-by shooting attack under roadblock checkpoint. The Sawa, or awakening militiamen, are former resistance fighters who sided with the Americans in 2007. They are regarded as traitors by many Iraqis. Baghdad, Iraq, Friday. 3 rockets hit a group of houses near the Baghdad International Airport, killing 2 people and wounding 8, according to police. 4 civilians were killed and 8 others were wounded, the source told Azawad al-Iraq News Agency. Baghdad, Iraq, Thursday. The 1920 Revolution Brigades claimed responsibility, blowing up a U.S. mine-clearing vehicle with an improvised explosive device in western Baghdad. Quote, the organization attacked a U.S. occupation force in patrol with an IED in western Baghdad, resulting in the destruction of the U.S. mine-removing vehicle and killing and wounding its crew. Letter released by the organization as received by Azawad al-Iraq News Agency. The U.S. Army denies the incident. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to pull the plug on all this violence and deliver on your campaign promises to end the war. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. For more than half of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, opponents of the wars have been holding a vigil outside Walter Reed Army Hospital every Friday from 7 to 9 p.m. So, how have the anti-war vigils at Walter Reed Army Hospital been going?
We are a steadfast vigil. We will be here as long as the United States is putting our young men and women and intervening in foreign countries and putting them in harm's way, we will be here. We will be here, to draw our last breath. We get support, so much support from the neighbors and the community, people who are returning from work, honk for us, stop and talk to us, the soldiers and their families stop and give us support.
And I saw that one of the right-wingers had a sign that said, troops, troops, nothing but troops. That sounds like their approach to foreign policy.
Well, I think their dream of the future is endless war. Endless war and endless war profiteering.
Yeah, I wonder if any of them have investments in the arms industry.
Well, they certainly don't seem to be investing their bodies where their, where their signs are.
Oh, that's right. They're over here and not over there, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray. It are genetically
16th of June. Animal rights protesters showed up at 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, home of three customers of puppy killing Huntington Life Sciences, Novartis, AstraZeneca, and yes, Bayer. One of the activists, who happens to be Jewish, called out Bayer for their role during World War II as part of the notorious IG Farben, maker of Zyklon B.
The billions of dollars is dead. That's not the half of it. Now that we found out that Bayer is still in this building, next to Mr. Ronald F. Rockstein, who's the VP of Government Relations, we also know you invented heroin and trademarked it up until World War I. Then you became part of IG Farben and made Zyklon B, and with a driving force behind the Auschwitz concentration camp. You dealt with Dr. Mengele and Fritz Tamir, who's involved in running a center against Auschwitz. He was also heavily involved with the Nazis. He was arrested as part of the Nuremberg trial and served 7 years in jail. And guess what happened to him, Mayor? He was put on as the head of Mayor AG after his involvement with the Nazis and after his imprisonment. And here's what he had to say. They were prisoners, thus no particular harm was inflicted, and they would have been killed anyway. A scholarship foundation exists today in his honor. Bayer has sold many, many products that have gone on to kill people, such as Baycom, which has killed 31 people in the U.S., 52 people worldwide, and over 1,000 have been crippled as a result of your drug, Bayer.
Security seemed awful interested in videotaping protesters after this stuff about Bayer's Nazi connections. You heard that, Bayer? So long as you do business with Huntington Life Sciences, people are going to talk about your past. Because in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. On the 17th of June, corner cutting, oil spewing, BP CEO Tony Hayward found he could not escape the wrath of the people. As he prepared for his interrogation at a congressional hearing, a protester shouted him down. Yeah, Tony, I'll bet you do want to fly away, but you belong in prison after what you've done to the Gulf of Mexico. Is Con Air good enough for you? There was also a disgusting note in the hearing when right-wing Republican nutjob Joe Bart had the nerve to call a $20 billion pittance BP is offering after meeting with the president, quote, a shakedown.
Amounts to a shakedown. So I apologize.
Mr. Joe Barton, how about you apologize for 20 years of drill baby drill that helped make BP's spill possible? Better yet, how about you and Tony Hayward both go down to the Gulf of Mexico with a spoon and start eating those tar balls? You two book the plane, I'll bring the spoons.
The news service ProPublica reports British Petroleum was warned repeatedly about their record of poor safety and environmental noncompliance in internal audits throughout the last decade. These warnings came in advance of several serious accidents in BP facilities in the U.S. BP's confidential reports showed the company ignored a rash of safety problems in Alaska, Texas, and California. According to these reports, BP management ignored warnings about aging infrastructure and pressured or harassed workers not to report safety problems and to cut short inspections to reduce production costs. An internal 2001 BP report on its Alaska operations noted the oil giant had neglected key equipment required for an emergency shutdown, including a safety cutoff valve and fire detectors. Similar equipment failed in the fire and explosion on the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico. In 2005, an emergency warning system failed before BP's Texas City oil refinery exploded into a ball of fire, after which an internal review found safety issues at all of BP's five refineries in the U.S. In 2009, the company was fined $87 million by OSHA for failing to upgrade safety compliance procedures at the Texas City plant. Former Environmental Protection Agency lawyer Jean Pascal, who investigated BP, asked, "At what point are we going to say we are not going to do business with BP anymore? None of the other super majors have an environmental criminal record like they do."
On the 19th of June, protesters showed up outside the BP gas station at 13th and N Streets in D.C., protesting BP's mammoth oil spill in the Gulf. This protest is not against any one franchise of BP. This protest is against BP's corporation. This station can easily pick up another franchise after BP goes bankrupt. But for BP to go bankrupt, people need to remember, don't buy gas at BP.
Boycott BP! Boycott BP! Boycott BP!
We got people coming in to buy gas at BP, even while people are here to remind them not to. Everybody knows what's wrong in the Gulf of Mexico with BP's oil blowout, yet here we got selfish drivers buying gas from BP when there are plenty of other gas stations in town.
Aren't that about right? The Grim Reaper set up at a BP station, symbolic of all the damage BP has done.
While protesters were deploying the BP gas stations, and oil workers desperately struggling to clean up BP's mess, guess where BP CEO Tony Haywood was reported to be going? Off to the yacht races, off Britain's Isle of Wight, to watch somebody else sail his yacht in a race. Out on the water to have a good time while other people were desperately trying to save the water in the Gulf of Mexico. Boycott British Petroleum. Boycott BP.
On the eve of President Obama's first address to the nation from the Oval Office on the continuing Gulf of Mexico oil spill, estimates for how much oil is gushing into the water from British Petroleum's blown-out well now range from 35,000 to 60,000 barrels a day, more than 7 to 12 times earlier estimates of 5,000 barrels daily. Representative Edward J. Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, contended that BP's lowballing of the amount of oil flowing into the Gulf was either deliberate deception or gross incompetence. Responding to criticism of his handling of the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history, President Obama has toured the Gulf Coast several times over recent weeks and named Michael Bromwich, a former Justice Department official, to clean up the government's Minerals Management Service, the agency that's under fire for its lax supervision of the nation's offshore oil drilling. But many environmental groups assert that it will take more than reorganizing government agencies to prevent future deadly oil spill disasters and coal mining accidents, but rather requires a national commitment to building a sustainable energy future. In a new report from Greenpeace and the European Renewable Energy Council titled Energy Revolution, A Sustainable USA Energy Outlook, the groups provide a comprehensive blueprint that they say will reduce carbon emissions while achieving economic growth by replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy and energy efficiency. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner, who discusses the Gulf oil disaster and the opportunity to reinvent the nation's broken energy infrastructure.
So, you know, we have to look at this from a couple of different angles, and obviously the first one is, what is our direct response to the disaster that's happened and is still happening, and how can we protect the ecosystem and the communities along the Gulf the most and the quickest? But then we also, I think, need to back up and realize that, you know, this time it was BP, but really the Minerals Management Service, which is a part of the Department of Interior, as you mentioned, has a very close relationship with the oil industry, and has for a long time. And it's that lax oversight that in part led to the disaster that we're seeing in the Gulf. But frankly, this sort of disaster is what we can expect if we continue to rely on fossil fuels like oil and coal indefinitely. Frankly, there's no way to do these things safely, and there's no way to do these things cleanly. So the only way to avoid accidents like this permanently is to quickly get ourselves off of oil and quickly get ourselves off of coal and embrace renewable energy like wind and solar that doesn't carry these sorts of risks.
Gabriel, describe for our listeners the importance of the Greenpeace report, Energy Revolution Evolution, a Sustainable USA Energy Outlook. What does that document tell us?
The Energy Revolution is a report that Greenpeace released with the European Renewable Energy Council. It's both a global report, and then there's a close look at the United States' role in it. And basically, it begins with the premise that we need to do what scientists tell us is required to prevent runaway climate change, with the understanding that if climate change goes unchecked, as it will if we don't act really boldly, the impacts will be hard to imagine. Economically, we're talking about major percentages of global GDP being spent on the adaptation and sort of late-stage mitigation of climate change, and then the human and environmental costs of climate change, just massive in terms of floods and droughts and food shortages and water shortages, rising seas. It really boggles the imagination to think of what could happen if we don't do anything. So this report starts with the assumption that we need to do to follow the science on climate change. And it looks at what technologies exist and what policies exist and have been tested in the real world to promote renewable energy. And it basically lays out a path, a roadmap, talking about how you can phase out fossil fuels like coal and oil and quickly ramp up both renewable energy like wind and solar and geothermal, but also how to squeeze every last drop out of the energy you're producing. We waste so much energy in this country and in the world that if we closed the window, so to speak, we could account for a lot of the projected growth in our energy demand. So it's basically a blueprint for how do we get from where we are now, dependent on fossil fuels, cleaning up an oily mess in the Gulf and mourning coal miners and here and looking at a future of unchecked climate change. How do we get from there to renewable, sustainable energy economy?
Gabriel, very often, particularly in news coverage of this British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, you hear pundits talking about the necessity to keep on drilling because this country is addicted to oil, and there's really no new technology or no new approach by government or industry that's going to replace oil in the near or long-term future. And that is the message that goes out to the American people over and over again, that there really is no hope to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels anytime soon. What message does this report from Greenpeace give us that contradicts that kind of doom and gloom scenario that we're going to be with oil and oil's going to be with us for a long, long time to come?
Yeah, that, you know, you just put your finger on it. That's a very, frankly, a very expensive lie that's put out there by the industry, and unfortunately is just sort of taken at face value and parroted by a lot of politicians and by a lot of people in the media that we can't, that we have to have fossil fuels, and that we simply have to deal with the sorts of things that we're dealing with now in the Gulf. And this report really pushes back on that lie and calls out the idea that, you know, if you take the bold steps in the short term to invest money in renewables and in efficiency, not only can you get off fossil fuels, but you can create a lot of jobs and save a lot of money in the meantime.
That was Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner. Contact Greenpeace USA at 1-800-326-0959 or visit their website at greenpeace.org, where you can download a copy of the group's Energy Revolution plan.
Upon his return to Peru, indigenous leader Alberto Pizango was arrested and soon released, only to face a criminal trial. His return from exile occurred nearly a year after a bloody conflict between police and protesters last June that left 34 people dead. Pizango, head of Peru's largest indigenous federation, AIDSTEP, faces charges of sedition, rebellion, and incitement to violence. The charges result from the bloody events in the northern city of Bagua, where activists resisted attempts by President Alan Garcia to open the Amazon to oil exploitation. Pizango returned to Lima, Peru, to proclaim his innocence. According to Amnesty International, the federation leader was in Lima on June 5th last year, the day of the confrontation in Bagua. 24 police officers and 10 civilians died in the incident. It was Peru's deadliest civil conflict since its military launched an offensive against the Maoist Shining Path guerrillas in the late 1980s. Several weeks before the confrontation, Pizango called for Peru's government to annul a series of land laws passed without the informed consent of indigenous peoples. On his return to Lima, Pizango expressed his regret for the loss of life at the Bagua blockades and his wish for a spirit of reconciliation among all Peruvians. Latino residents of Arizona are starting to flee in anticipation of the state's tough new immigration law taking effect. According to USA Today, schools in Arizona's Latino neighborhoods are reporting sharp enrollment declines. Local ethnic businesses serving Hispanic residents are also struggling. The new immigration law, along with the impact of the severe recession since 2008, has hit the Latino population, both legal and undocumented, especially hard. Arizona's new immigration law requires police officers to ask about a person's immigrant status during routine traffic stops if there is any suspicion they may be in the U.S. illegally. In addition, the law makes it a state crime to be in the U.S. illegally, or to disrupt traffic to hire day laborers, whether the worker's status is illegal or not. David Gutierrez, a professor at the University of California, San Diego, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The economy is always the primary factor in determining migration flows. It might appear that the law is turning back the demographic tide in Arizona, but economic factors are a much more important aspect." The population exodus comes as Arizona has also been hard hit by a growing tourism and convention boycott triggered by its new draconian immigration law.
Your name?
Kate Hadley.
And your organization, Kate Hadley?
The Student Farmworker Alliance.
And what do they do?
The Student Farmworker Alliance is an ally organization to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and we organize with youth and students around the Coalition of Immokalee Workers campaign for fair food.
We're standing in a model truck on the National Mall. Explain why the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has set up this museum. What is it?
So this box truck is a replica of the truck in which workers from the latest slavery case were locked up inside. They're chained by the wrists, the door is padlocked, they're forced to go to the bathroom in the corner, all so that they would be available to work in the tomato fields the next day.
And this took place down in Florida?
Yes, this took place in Immokalee, Florida.
I wanted to read from the wall here. It says, "On the evening of November 18, 2007, four workers were locked in the back of a truck, much like this one, by their employers, Cesar and Giovanni Navarrete, in order to ensure that they would be available to pick tomatoes the next morning. In the middle of the night, the workers decided to try and get out, punched a hole in the roof of the truck, and escaped to freedom. The hole they used to escape was located directly above where we're standing now." For people that don't know, the people who are hearing this for the first time, what is the situation like for those picking tomatoes and other crops?
So in general, there is an extreme amount of poverty and powerlessness across the board in the agricultural industry, in the tomato industry in Florida. Workers receive 40 to 45 cents per 32-pound bucket of tomatoes. There's physical violence in the fields. Workers have no basic labor protections, receive no benefits, receive no overtime pay, and don't have the right to organize to change those conditions. Those are the everyday conditions that in their extreme are able to tip over into slavery and become situations like those that you see inside of this box truck.
I picked up that you have a demonstration, the tomatoes, 32 pounds. It's a lot. And you said that in order to make $50 a day, you have a picker has to, what, load 2 tons of tomatoes?
Yes, 2 tons of tomatoes to make around $50 per day.
In the hot sun.
In the hot Florida sun.
And one of the things you have the federal government, yesterday you had the State Department, and the federal government has intervened in some instances to stop this. But as we were speaking earlier, you talked about, Kate Hadley, going forward, the ways to prevent this from happening going forward.
And so, yes, these cases that are exhibited in the truck, these 6 cases, including the case that this truck is based off of, are all cases that were federally prosecuted, that were brought to justice with the help of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, working with the Department of Justice and the FBI. And so these are cases that already happened, that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, working with these other governmental organizations, were able to get federally prosecuted. But the analysis behind the museum and the analysis behind the Campaign for Fair Food is that you don't want to go case by case by case, ending cases that have already happened. You want to address slavery at the root and make sure that these cases, that these slavery operations aren't able to happen in the first place. And so that's exactly what the Campaign for Fair Food does. It addresses these root conditions, these root causes of slavery. And so that is the poverty and powerlessness that workers in the agricultural industry face. And so that 40 to 45 cents per bucket of tomatoes, end up being sub-poverty wages for workers, the lack of right to organize to change the conditions in the fields, all reasons why those are the everyday conditions that are able to, in their extreme, tip over into becoming modern-day slavery cases.
And one of the asks right now is that the amount that pickers are paid increases a penny per pound.
And so, yes, the Campaign for Fair Food calls on corporate buyers of tomatoes to pay an extra penny per pound, so an extra 32 cents per bucket of tomatoes, directly to the farm workers, which isn't very much money for those corporations, but almost doubles farm worker wages.
Almost doubles it.
Yes, because they go from 40 to 45 cents to 72 to 77 cents.
Who do people need to know the names of? You said mentioned Whole Foods and McDonald's and a few others that are now doing that, but then Giant and Stop and Shave are possibly not helping out in this effort.
And so the corporations that have already come to the table and are already working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, it began with Taco Bell in 2005, and then McDonald's, Burger King, Whole Foods, Subway, Bon Appetit, Compass Group, and Aramark have all come to the table and are all working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and are paying an extra penny per pound for farm worker wages. They've agreed to a supplier code of conduct for their tomato suppliers, which includes a zero tolerance policy for slavery. So not only does that code of conduct address the everyday abuses that occur, but also addresses the most extreme, most egregious abuse, which is forced labor, requiring those companies that are working with, those corporations that are working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to immediately cut contracts with any grower that is found to have been tainted by a slavery case. The third part of those agreements, those fair food agreements, is worker involvement in the development and implementation of the code of conduct and of those agreements. And so those 8 corporations that I just mentioned before are all already working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We are calling on, as part of the supermarket campaign, are calling on Ahold as one of the targets. And Ahold is the parent company of Stop and Shop and Giant. And so those companies have not yet come to the table, but we're calling on them in hopes that they will work in partnership with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to address the conditions in the fields, to address the sub-poverty wages of workers, to make sure that slavery is not able to happen in the first place.
Kate Hadley, is it true that what farm workers are excluded from the National Labor Relations Act?
Yes, so farm workers and domestic workers were excluded from New Deal legislation from the National Labor Relations Act, and so for that reason don't have many of the basic labor protections that other workers in other industries have, including the right to organize to change the conditions that they confront every day in the workplace.
What do you hope that folks visiting this museum and this truck where people punched a hole out of to escape to freedom. What do you hope that they'll take away from visiting this?
So first and foremost, we hope to raise awareness. A lot of people don't know that slavery is still happening in this day and age, in this country. And so we hope that people come out of the truck, come out of the museum, realizing that these things are still happening. And we hope that it inspires them to get involved in the campaign, to get involved in the solution that's already being forged by farm workers to put an end to these abuses.
And they've had some success over the years. We were speaking earlier, and you mentioned how it took the campaign to bring Taco Bell to the table took 4 years, and then the campaign for McDonald's 2 years, Burger King 1 year, Subway even less. Talk about the success of farm workers becoming more politicized.
So in terms of the Taco Bell campaign, it was the first time when Taco Bell came to the table to negotiate with the CIW, it was the first time that a major corporation had ever come to the table, the same table as farm workers. And so that campaign took 4 years. It was unprecedented what happened. The subsequent campaigns each took less time because it started to set an industry standard, the first agreement with Taco Bell. And so we're hoping that that trend continues and that more and more corporations come to the table and join this growing partnership of farm workers and corporations working together to address these conditions that farm workers face.
What role can colleges play in this?
So I'm part of the Student Farm Worker Alliance, which is an ally organization to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and we organize around the campaign in partnership with the farm workers that are part of the CIW. And so college students can definitely become involved in the campaign as consumers, as students, and so they can be part of those groups around the country that are organizing to bring these other corporations to the table and put pressure on them and get them to work with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Each university must buy an awful lot of food to feed their student population. Any final thoughts you want to share, Kate Hadley?
So students and youth have always been an integral part to bringing these corporations to the table. As a target market of these fast food companies, students and youth have always played a big role in pressuring these companies to sign agreements. The same goes for the food service providers such as Aramark and Compass that have already signed on board. Some of the largest, those are the four fast food companies that have signed agreements are the four largest fast food companies. Compass is the largest food service provider. Students on universities with Compass and Aramark organized tirelessly and helped bring those huge corporations to the table as well. And so right now, Sodexo is the lone holdout. It's the one major food service provider in the country that has yet to sign an agreement. And we're hoping that because of student pressure, Sodexo will come to the table and will work with the CIW to end the human rights crisis that's occurring in Florida's fields.
And the human rights crisis is kind of exemplified by, we're looking here at these chains that people were locked up in overnight. And it says workers locked into the truck overnight had no bathroom facilities available to them, forced to go in the bathroom in the corner of this truck, and they are locked up using these chains. It's pretty palpable how problematic the situation is.
Yes, and the cases exhibited in the truck have involved well over 1,000 workers, and the federal prosecutor in the latest case, the 2008 case, U.S. versus Navarrete, said himself, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And we know that there are other cases going on, and we know that the cases exhibited in this truck are just a fraction of the slavery that's occurring in Florida's fields.
Thank you so much.